Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to pick up talking about strategies for how viruses can manage to get their code run when they modify an executable. But before I start, some logistical stuff. So I should have edited the due dates. So assignments will be due 11:59 p.m. from now on. Just beware that if you ask a question at 6 p.m. on a Friday, I might not answer till Saturday, so try not to do that. And speaking of assignments, before I move on to today's topic, are there any questions, comments on the current assignment that's due Friday? Everyone's happy with where they are, not totally confused, or didn't look at it at all. Okay. So let's get back to looking at our second option for ways viruses can run code, besides the simplest thing, which is just replacing that starting address. That was simple because replacing the starting address, you definitely run. It's in a known location in our modern executable formats, and you just copy the old one and put a jump to it or a call to it at the end of your virus code. And we had one strategy for several strategies for editing code that we know was going to run anyways. And this whole family of strategies we're talking about today are what Zur calls entry point obscuring, because they make things harder for antivirus software. And we'll talk a bit about sort of antivirus strategies, and we'll see that many of the things we've looked at are kind of reactions to what antivirus software is probably doing. And one strategy we started with was, you know, that you could, say, find this sort of empty space after a ret where conveniently you could just put a jump. And because you know that probably a ret followed by a no-op probably is something that's safe to replace, so this was safe to do. And there were other strategies where maybe you were less sure, where you could, you know, look for things which look like functions based on compilers commonly starting functions in a particular way, like by updating a frame pointer. And then use this to identify, along with calls, when you had a call to a real function, you know, places where, oh, this code's probably going to be called at some point. I can put the entry point to my virus here, and that will work out. Where I can replace this call with a call to my virus and have my virus call the real function when it's done. And that'll not change the other behavior of the program. So there's some other types of places where there's easily identified places where code that definitely gets run and is easy to change is. Can anyone think of any we talked about earlier when we talked about how executable formats worked? So remember, we talked about dynamic linking. And in dynamic linking, the linker did all these tricks to avoid having to replace lots of calls at runtime. And the central strategy was that they replaced those calls to what would be in another file that was loaded later with a call to a stub, this sort of placeholder function, you know, that typically had this jump to something looked up in a table. And these are at a well-known location in the executables. It's actually easy to find from the executable format because typically they're in their own section with a name that you can look up mechanically. You don't need to actually try to read this code, but you could also look for this pattern in the file. You just say, well, it's not very often we're going to see a jump followed by a push, a jump to a table lookup followed by a push followed by a jump. That's a pretty easy pattern to look for. But it's also in like a known section of the file. So this is something that real malware has looked for. And they said, well, we can just replace this jump here where that looks up something in a table with a jump to our code. And then have our code look up something in the table when it's done. And you know, the dynamic linker doesn't change this stuff. It changes the offset table. So this is going to get your code run, and you have to be looking for it to find this change that suddenly printf calls the virus, or put S in this case. And it's a good strategy. Another common sort of replacement is that you can replace things like function pointers. And this also occurs in this stuff. So maybe instead of replacing the code here that looks something up in the table, we can just replace this entry of the initial version of the table. And if you remember what happened with our lazy binding, where the dynamic linker decided it's not going to actually fill in this table when it starts the program, it's going to wait until it actually needs to. So with our lazy binding, this table was initially set to point to this push queue. So the virus can just modify the executable to have this table entry point to the virus. And then when the virus is done, it jumps to the push queue. The dynamic linker updates the table as usual, and everything else proceeds as if nothing else happened. And while these stubs are in a known location in the file, that's something you can find. You have to look for the right pattern and make sure you aren't that it's not a different type of dynamic linker with a slightly different way of writing jumps. But this global offset table here, that's also easy to find. Probably easier. You just look for that name in the symbol table, and you can look for an entry which has an address which looks kind of like a function's address would be. So another option is other linking information. So in addition to those actual table entries, there's also what the dynamic linker is going to do to fill in those table entries. And if you remember, the dynamic linker looked at relocation entries and symbol table entries. And both of these effectively contain pointers to functions. The relocation table entries contain a name of a function or some other way of identifying a function. And the symbol table entries map a name of a function to its offset within a file, basically. And in either case, we could change the offset in a file in the symbol table to point to some virus code, and then just that virus code just needs to jump back when it's done to where the original offset was. Or we could edit a relocation entry to point to the virus instead of wherever it pointed before. Maybe this most likely pointed to some libc, in this case pointed to putS. And we just need to somehow figure out how to call putS when we're done or emulate what it does. So this is a strategy that doesn't actually appear for executables. And the main problem is that these dynamic relocation records, the things that the runtime linker use, usually don't have a way of specifying the main executable. So underscore start is the name of our entry point when you saw the RE assignment. That was the name of the entry point function. It's the original name. And you saw that in your object dump output. So you might assume, that's in the executable somewhere, so can't I use it as a name in my relocation? But it turns out for dynamic relocations, you can't. So there's a different table for some of the information object dump was showing you, which is not used by the dynamic linker. It's used by other linkers, compile time linker, and by the debuggers. But the dynamic linker has a much more compact table, which typically doesn't contain things from the executable. So on Linux, for example, unless you link with this option, minus R dynamic, or something equivalent to it, your executable symbols will not be available to the dynamic linker. And most programs are not linked this way. The case where you want to link this way is if you're loading something at runtime and you want it to call it back into your executable by name. That's not very common. The C standard library is not going to call back to your function by name. The case where that happens would be something like your browser and you're loading a browser plugin. That browser plugin is going to call a browser function like to display a web page. That's a case where you might want to do this, but for common applications, we aren't going to load libraries that we expect to call back into us, so you just don't link to have that information available. But even though this doesn't really work on executables, because you can't just put the name of something in the function, it does work on libraries. And it turns out that there's viruses which infect not executables, not just executables, but infect library files. And commonly the way they do this is by, they might infect the symbol table. They could also affect the relocations. And they just say, yeah, here's my, append their virus code and say, yeah, that get file attributes function that all these applications are calling, yeah, it's really my virus. And this is particularly valuable because this means that if you infect something like whatever library would contain a function called get file attributes, which would be kernel 32 DLL on Windows, that's probably used by pretty much every executable. So you basically get to run with every executable on the system for one file modification. Yes?
So in this way, when it wants to spread, the virus, would it have to just find another, get someone to some another person's computer and then add it there? Because it seems like this way, the block would need to add to everyone.
Yeah. So the question is, we usually don't have something like kernel32.dll we share. We're not going to share the system library that contains this. So the question is, how does this virus spread? So there's two possibilities. So one is that it could infect DLLs and executables in a different way. It could infect executables, but in a different way. So it could do this to infect the DLL and do something more like what Vienna does, for example, to infect executables. So it might do both. Because as I said, infecting the DLL is very valuable because you get to run in every executable. It's also a lot harder to fix. This is an important system file that's used all the time. Not as easy to replace as a normal program. The other way it could work is that commonly, programs you have might come with libraries that they use internally that are in the application folder. And this would infect those. In addition to the system libraries. The system libraries are maybe the more effective thing for hiding, but it would probably also infect normal sort of one application libraries. So we talked about a whole bunch of ways of somehow adding code and getting it to run. And there's different strategies for that. And the next assignment, which is out after Friday, is called Tricky. The idea is you're going to insert a tricky jump, one of these funny jumps from the middle of normal code, into an executable. In this case, we have a ret followed by some no-ops that don't do anything because of aligning the functions. And you need to submit a program which will take an executable we give you and modify it to have this jump, and also to insert some virus code quote-unquote virus code, which will just print out a string that we will give you in another obvious empty space. So this is easier than the real scenario, and notably, we're not going to require the program you give us to work on any other executable, so you can hard code addresses, but we'd like you to answer a question about how you would generalize it. Yes?
So if you're replacing the ret, will it no longer function as the original?
So the question is, if I'm replacing the ret, won't that break the original program? And so what we're going to do is we're going to supply you with virus code, which ends with a ret. So you're going to replace the ret with a jump or a push then ret. Something equivalent to a jump that might be easier for you to write. And then that code you're going to run is going to print out a string and then ret. So it's going to do the ret on behalf of the replaced one. And this is a nice, easy strategy for infecting files than having a hidden entry point that real viruses have used. Yes?
After we jump somewhere, is it still within the same function so it can just call it?
So the question is, after we jump somewhere, are we still within the same function so we can call rat? So the question is, what's your notion of the same function? And as far as rat is concerned, what matters is what's on the stack. And as long as you haven't gotten rid of the return address that rat's going to read from the stack, returning will still work. And we're not going to do that in the virus code we supply, and you're not going to do that in what you do to implement the jump. So any other questions on this assignment before you've actually seen it? I presumably, yeah.
So when you say, like, we're going to insert something, do we have to, like, write code that inserts something, or are we supposed to
You're supposed to supply us with a program which will read the executable we supply as input and output a new one
that has
these modifications, and that program should be much, much smaller than something which just prints out a static copy of the modified file. Yes, you could do this by just having a program which outputs the modified file that you figured out once, but don't know. Your program should just read it in, make the little changes, and output it.
And will when you're doing this to us, will it say where you're supposed to jump to, or are we supposed to also
You are responsible for inserting the virus code. I have given you an executable which has a very long section of null ops, so it should be easy to find. In a real virus, you need to modify the header to add space, or hope that there's enough space in a cavity somewhere and you need to figure out where that is. We're not going to have you do that, just keep things simpler. But prior versions of this assignment just had the virus code already in there, but I didn't feel that that was very interesting or made sense. Yeah. We will give you a .s file, which is the code to jump to. The reason I'm giving this to you is because it needs to be written so it works anywhere in the executable, which you could figure out, but I'd like to at least show you an example of doing that. You know, because I don't expect you to figure out how to change any, if it loaded a string with an address. You would have to change that if you were writing it yourself, or somehow figure out how to load a string with a relative offset. So I've given you code which loads a string with a relative offset and calls the write to screen function without a relative offset, rather than having you figure out how to do that yourself, which I think you could do, but probably a bit much for a 1 week assignment, when you'll probably be struggling to make sure you figured out the right offset in the file. Other questions? Okay, so we went through a whole bunch of things that viruses have and could do. And you might wonder, why did I bother talking about all of these? Why can't viruses just always append or replace the easiest possible thing? Why don't they just always change the start location, the simplest possible thing to change, rather than looking for these funny other places to modify the file, which is going to require a whole bunch of other code to parse executables, look for patterns in machine code, hope you don't have any false positives because maybe the program has some compressed data which happens to look like a jump or a ret. So why do viruses go through all this trouble? So anyone have some guess? Yes?
If a virus does the same thing every, all viruses work together.
Yeah, so the problem is antivirus. Is that antivirus could easily figure out any of these strategies. And so all these things I've talked about are sort of reactions to antivirus existing. That someone tried to lock down one strategy, so they used another one. And we're going to talk more about things viruses do, some of which are more obviously reactions to things antivirus software does. But first, we're going to talk about sort of basic antivirus strategies. And the way I like to view this is that this is a cat and mouse game from Tom and Jerry. who, you know, Tom never really catches Jerry. And that seems to be how the antivirus and virus fields work. And everyone is escalating, and we'll see that sort of escalation as we go through, for this first part of the semester, various things that viruses do and that antivirus software does in response and so on. So generally we have these different things that antivirus software tries to do. So tries to prevent it from spreading and prevent it from running. And also one thing it often cares about doing is trying to undo the effects of malware. And an important part for all of these tasks is figuring out when you have malware, like just a yes or no answer. And ideally which one you have, especially if you want to undo effects, you need to know actually exactly what one you have. For any of these others, is it good enough to know, yes, this is malware, no, it is not. And the simplest thing to do, well, let's just have a copy of every possible malicious executable and just check to see if it's one of those. Just, you know, every executable infected with every virus. You could just make a big database, you know, store it in the cloud somewhere, just send a query. But this is not actually a very efficient strategy. So instead, you know, and also you're comparing every program, so you just read every program. You can do it. I mean, you basically read the program every time you run it. But that's not actually what we want to do. We want something better than that. So typically, they have what are known as signatures. Some compact way of representing a piece of malware. And they have some goals for signatures, which are possibly a little conflicting. So one thing is that they want signatures to be compact. They want to have the antivirus software not need to have hundreds of megabytes of copies of various versions of malware in order to do its detection. They want them to be fast to check. They want, you know, they don't want it to be the case that when you download a file from the internet that the antivirus software needs to spend 10 minutes going through that 20 meg file looking for things. And they want them to be reliable. And there's two kinds of reliability they really care about. So one thing is they want to actually find the malware the signature was built for. The other thing is that they don't want to find other things that aren't malware. It's not good if this triggers on a random innocent program just because the signature was a little too optimistic about what real programs look like. So we went through in reasonable detail how the Vienna virus worked, at least one sample of it. So how would you construct a signature for that virus? What are some ideas about what a signature should look like? Starting there. So one signature idea is that maybe if the first command in the virus is a jump, so in the program is a jump, like that's probably not something we think normal programs do. Any other ideas? Yes.
Always equivalent. You could like take up a list of instructions and hash it.
Okay. Other ideas? Back there?
You could look for something that you know that the virus does, like Vienna marked files by 7 seconds to the CPU.
Okay. So. And let's do this, and go. Okay. And that is, this is a big screen. Okay, any other ideas? Everyone? Yes. Okay. So, yeah, we'll do probably that size. So 100 as a memory address. Okay, yeah. Okay, so psi as memory address base. Okay, any other things we should look for? Yeah. Okay, so we have a list of things here. List of, I should say, probably constant instructions. And we had our three criteria I gave, which it was compact, fast to check, and reliable. So the first command is a jump. Do people think that that's compact? A compact signature? Yes. Do people think that that's fast to check? Yes. Do people think that that's reliable? Iffy. So maybe someone would want their COM file to really start somewhere else. It's not clear, probably not common, but it doesn't seem like the best idea. Just from a, maybe there's some program that someone wrote out there which was coded funny and has a jump there, and that's perfectly legitimate. How about our hash of list of constant instructions? So is that compact? Yes? So who thinks it's compact? So I think it's probably compact. Is this fast to check? People are shaking their heads. It sounds pretty bad to need to look for something which hashes to something anywhere in the executable. Yeah?
Well, a slight modification you can make to that is act like it's like a tree. So instead of a hash list, you just have like a tree, and you find the first instruction, okay, look for the second instruction, and if it's there, you would progress down the tree, and if you got all the way to the bottom of the tree, you'd say it's a virus. But if you found an instruction that wasn't like the next instruction, then you would just...
A substring of constant instructions, and we just search for the substring basically. So that might be faster. So the hash is easier to store, but having the actual list of instructions in some form, your tree is a form of that basically, is faster to check, it would seem. Metadata marked with 60, files marked with 62 seconds, well, that's pretty good. It's fast to check, it's compact, it's pretty reliable, no one probably should be doing that. How about this reference to hex 100 as a memory address? So, is that compact? Well, I can say it pretty compactly, but I'm not sure how I would implement that. It seems like that you need to come up with something more specific about, like, I'm looking for a move from 100 followed by a instruction that writes memory. You need to do a lot more to express this in a way you could actually write in code. It's plausible. But that sounds like it's probably not fast to check. Maybe it is. It depends on how specific you are and how many cases you catch. How about reliability? Is that idea reliable?
Everybody knows that it's 100 is a ELF, right?
It's a COM file, yeah. There might be other reasons to do it. Some programs might want to like use all their memory and they're done with their start section. But it's not unreasonable to assume that program shouldn't do that. But it doesn't seem super reliable. And we have similar problems with this idea of lots of use of SI. This is a pattern we could look for. But actually expressing this in a precise enough way that you could have code which checks this seems tricky. You have to say, what does it mean for it to be using SI too much? That also probably means it's not super reliable. But these are all like real ideas and real things you might imagine antivirus software trying. So And I came up with sort of similar ideas about things you might look for. So, you know, you have jump. You can take all the constant code, which happens for Vienna, to be everything from this push to this ret that doesn't change when the virus propagates. So you can just look for that whole string. And it's really unlikely to be a false positive because it contains infection code. So, not sure, you shouldn't be putting infection code in the middle of your benign executables. You could look for something else, like as you, like something, some variant of, as mentioned, this accessing address hex 100. That's a perfectly fine thing to look for, especially if you're jumping back to it. That's a more specific thing you could look for than just writing around it. That is probably pretty reliable. It seems like a weird thing to do, is to modify the code that was at your entry point and then jump back to it. So these are all plausible signatures. And some of these signatures that you came up with possibly detect other programs. So that was an advantage. So if we here, so which ones, so some of these might detect other viruses. So this is not just Vienna. So anything which works like Vienna, which uses the same strategy for starting, would be detected by this. This is just Vienna. This is just Vienna. This would not be not just Vienna, so someone else would have to come up with a different strategy for marking their files to avoid reinfecting them. Someone who tried to use the same strategy might do that. This is probably not just Vienna, because it's, again, the same strategy that Vienna used to start in the executable. And this would probably not be just Vienna, though it seems like changing from SI to something else isn't really a big problem. So we have some generality there. And in fact, the Vienna virus is an example of a virus which has many, many variants. So people copied the virus a bunch of times, probably not in small part due to it being published, so which is the same reason I used it as an example, because I had the code easily available. And people usually made small changes. So it's beneficial to come up with patterns which survive those small changes. And those small changes are usually to things that they want to do, like a print a message or do something actually malicious after infecting files. And our simplest signature of just all the code won't detect any variants, but some of the other ones you came up with will. So we had our ones based on the start code, and we have a problem that maybe applications do it. And there's another problem, which is, you know, it's a little bit of work to not have that jump right there, but it's probably not that hard to find another place to put the jump. It's a little bit hard because you have to make sure you aren't writing a jump in the middle of another instruction. So that is effort, but you probably could look for a pattern which looks like an instruction you can safely replace, for example. Or you can have an actual instruction length parser. You could have a signature where instead of taking the whole code, you just take the part which does the infection, on the assumption that people are going to be too lazy to modify that loop. And if they weren't reacting to you doing this, if they weren't adversaries who actually paid attention to what you were doing, this would be probably pretty fine. But the problem is, if they noticed that adding a NOP in the middle of their infection code makes them not be detected by your antivirus software, they're going to do it. Yes. So the question is, how does the author of the virus know how the antivirus software is attacking their code? So the easiest thing is that they can buy it too. And they can just experimentally see what works. And you can make some pretty good guesses. And later on in the semester, we're going to talk about strategies for evading antivirus software, which close out whole classes of things antivirus software can do, which will basically like make all this signature stuff we're talking about not work. And another example of a signature, as I mentioned, the ending code. And what's interesting about that is that it's push and ret, because doing a relative jump would require more relocation code. So this is something that, again, is easy to change, relatively speaking, but it's at least it's effort to change it, because you have to use a different strategy to change where the code is. So actually, we have our three strategies, or four criteria here, is that we want them to be reliable, we want them to be kind of general. We want them to survive trivial modifications. We want to catch Vienna and the person who found the source code to Vienna and change three things in it. So we have this basic notion of what signature checking is like. And a good question is, how fast is it? And that's going to depend on what kind of signatures we're going to use. And there's sort of two issues going on. One is going to be that we just have to read the whole thing in order to do the check, which turns out to be more of a problem today than it used to be back in the DOS era. And the question is, how complicated are the signatures? If we're talking about signatures, we're saying, are you accessing address 100 hex with a memory write? That seems pretty complicated to check. But looking for a particular string is pretty simple. And one method, which we'll talk about because it's basically the fast thing to do, is regular expressions. So who here has seen regular expressions before? So most of you. So we'll probably go through this quickly. So we'll have an assignment where we'll use Flex, which is a parser generator. It's meant for parsing languages, but it basically is a multiple regular expression matcher. And the reason we're talking about regular expressions is that if you want to check signatures quickly and check lots of them quickly, this is basically the fastest thing you can do. And expresses the full power of the things you can do quickly. And there are lots of implementations. So as I said, we're using Flex later in this course. And I'm going to go through Flex's regular expression syntax. If you may have seen other syntaxes, Flex is probably a little less featured than you'd like. Though it also does things that you may not be used to, like you give it a list of expressions and it matches any of them, the first one which matches, which is probably not how you're used to using regular expressions, but more useful for checking for signatures. So regular expressions are going to be written as a string. It's a programming language for writing these simple, fast-to-check signatures, patterns. And most characters, at least especially alphanumeric characters, all represent themselves. So a regular expression which says this is that matches the string foo is exactly foo, because it's all alphanumeric characters. Some people look confused. Sorry?
Why doesn't it match the foo that looks the same?
Oh, sorry. That is an error on this slide. Oh, that is a, there is supposed to be a visible space there. And there isn't. Because I apparently used the wrong way of coding code. I will correct this when I post these slides, probably. For other characters, you sometimes need a backslash. So if you want to match the string C++, you need C backslash plus backslash plus. There are also non-alphanumeric characters, sometimes what are called meta characters. They have some meaning, special meaning, and don't match themselves. So we have backslash introduces things like in C, which specify special characters. So if you want new lines, tabs, or some specific hexadecimal number as a character, you can specify it that way. And this is going to be important because we're going to use this not to match like human readable strings, but to match machine code. You can also specify sets and ranges of characters. So you can say B through F or I. You could also use this with something like backslash X3C. So you could use this to match machine code where you say this opcode or this opcode or this opcode. And so this actually gives you reasonable flexibility to detect lots of patterns of the sort, like function, like things which write to address 100. You can actually come up with a pattern. It's a bunch of work, but you can come up with a pattern you can express in this form to do that. You know, like you need to look through how the machine code works, and we're going to need some other operators I'm not showing you to do it. But we have the flexibility to do that. Because this is built for parsing files, text files, dot matches any character except new line. But you can specify that I want to match something or something else. And the general syntax for doing that is that you put parentheses around things to group them and use this OR operator to say the first thing or the second thing. So this matches dot or new line, and that turns out to be any character. And you can use that in general. So for example, I can match AB or CD, or I can, with something like this, and I can use this with parentheses in the middle of something, so I could match, say, a move or a move of one kind or a move of another kind. So I could specify actually pretty general patterns if I'm willing to put in the effort to write it. So there's also meta characters for specifying repeated things, which is, so you can say, well, I have some virus code, then I have some other code that I don't care about that takes up some amount of space, so you can specify, you know, if it's zeros or something, you can use star to say repeat something. So in this case, I'm repeating A's, saying zero or more A's, but I could also repeat something in parentheses like any character. So I could say like 60, 0 to 60 of any character, or any number of any character, and then something else. So I can use this to find patterns which have some code and then some code later. And since most of you have seen regular expressions before, I assume this is pretty familiar to you that used a similar regular expression syntax. Yes? No? No? Some people are no. Yeah. So this is probably, so star basically means one or zero or more of the previous thing. You sometimes might have seen plus to mean one or more. I don't know if flex has that. Star is simplest. You can specify ranges of things. So this is the previous thing for 3, 5 here is A, so that's 3 to 5 A's. In this case, there's something in parentheses before it, so that's 3 to 5 ABCs, so exactly these strings. And then we have alternation, which I mapped. So give more complex examples. This matches parts of words ending, I should have put a star there. This matches something followed by ing. Some wet word followed by, so four letter words followed by ing. And if I put a star there, it would be three to more letter words followed by ing. And this is a pattern for matching a C comment. Yes. Yes, any number of any of those letters and any combinations, yes. Yeah.
How does that specify four letters?
Because this matches, the thing in brackets matches a single character, which is any one of the ones in the brackets. So I will go back to my list here. So the pattern I meant to write probably is this. So that would match ing or bing zing or yeah and so on. But this pattern this you need to fill in with, needs to be A or B or C or D or Z or A or B or C or Z. Yes. So this star case is any sequence of those characters. Yeah, so this would work because this B matches A through Z, this E matches A through Z, this A matches A through Z, and this R matches A through Z. Okay. So those are the patterns I met, and that's apparently the problem with proofreading code on slides, which is not a strength. And then we have our pattern, which I think is actually correct, to match C++ comments. We need to do some funny things here. Like we need to put a backslash in front of all the stars because that just normally means one or more of something. And the backslash says, nope, not special anymore. And we need to match something which is not a star or is a star followed by not a slash. And we match either of those things any number of times, followed by a star, followed by a slash. Yes?
Why wouldn't you just put dot star as the contents?
Why would you put dot star? So the question is, why wouldn't you put dot star? So we need to at least match new lines.
But when you use those other brackets, they can be multiple lines. When you use the slash star, you can go several lines down.
Yeah, so you couldn't put dot star. We need to at least put dot or new line star. And I think dot or new line star would probably be the same. This might be more efficient to implement for reasons we'll talk about maybe a little later. Yes?
So if your star is in the brackets, that one doesn't need the backslash?
The star here? Yes. So it doesn't need it, but if you put it there, it's not a problem. So you can always put backslashes on things you think might be special without worrying about whether or not they're really special. It turns out that in brackets, the star is not special. So it doesn't need it, but if I added it, it would not be a problem. Other comments, questions, confusion? Yeah.
Carrot.
I think I had that on a previous slide, but if I didn't, that is not good of me. Yes, so the caret means anything but. That is an important thing to point out. So this matches any character but that one, any character but a star. So in this case, we're matching anything but a star or a star followed by anything but a slash. Okay, so as I said, we're going to be using a tool later called Flex. So Flex is a regular expression matching tool intended for parsing things like programming languages. It's very fast because it takes your list of regular expressions and generates C code. So pretty much generates the fastest parser you can generate. By convention, it generates a function that you'll call from a main you write called yylex, which runs the parser, which by default reads from standard in, right, and does its job on whatever standard in points to. So let me show you an example Flex file. So this file is divided into three sections, which is the convention of Flex, which are divided by these double percent signs. The first section is declarations. These are just going to be, there's some other types of declarations we'll talk about, but declarations that are indented like this are just going to be copied directly into the C file. So the C file that's produced is going to have these global variables, num bytes, num lines, and num foos. Then we have patterns. So the pattern appears here. So this is the regular expression foo. This is the regular expression dot. This is the regular expression backslash n for new line. And next to each of the patterns is something to process that match. So every time we match foo, we increment numbytes by 3 and add 1 to numfoos. Every time we match dot, we increment numbytes by 1. Every time we match new line, we increment numlines by 1 and numbytes by 1. And finally, in the third section, we have extra code to include. In this case, I've put a main function in there. So that's going to be copied into the C file it outputs. So it will have a main function so we can compile it as a standalone program. And this main function calls the parser, which is generated with the name yylex, unless you use some command line options to change that. And then prints out the values of numbytes, numlines, and numfoos. So if you run this with flex, and then provide it an input file, it will tell you how many foos, bytes, and lines it has. Yes? So what do you mean, which part of any language? So Flex is built for parsing programming languages. So if you were using this to parse a programming language, instead of foo, you'd have like int and char as the things you were matching. Or like, or plus sign or minus sign, the sorts of things you want to find in programs. In this case, we're not going to be doing that. We're going to be looking for other patterns. But it's the same mechanism.
So would the examples be an input of a C file, and we're using Flex to look for patterns in that input C file?
So you could provide any file as input, and it will look for these patterns in it. In this case, these patterns should match on pretty much any file, and they'll just give different results. And that's probably what your goal is if you're looking for malware. So you want patterns which match in any file, and sometimes do something saying, yeah, we found something bad. And we'll just choose the code here to take appropriate action. So in the assignment we're going to give you, that action is going to be, we want you to print out, oh, I found this suspicious pattern at this byte. And you'll match everything else and just skip over it. Yes, back there.
What's the difference between using Flex and just using the built-in?
So the main difference is that here we just specified a list of patterns, and we know which one matches each time, which is not so easy to do with the standard Python regular expression library. The other difference is that Flex is going to actually generate code which is very efficient at looking for all these regular expressions at once. Rather than like in Python, if you like try to match one, then the other, then the next one, and see which one matched. It's going to do something better than that. Okay. So another thing you can do with Flex is you can look at the match text. So there's a variable called yytext that Flex defines. You'll notice everything starts with yy, just history. You can change what that is to something else if you really want, but by default it's yy. So this matches a word starting A through Z and prints out that word. So yytext is a buffer of what was currently matched. So you can use this to like look at the contents of what was matched. So if you were talking about looking at malware, like you could look at the string that was matched and maybe extract an address and do some other checks on it, or print out, you know, exactly what it is and is for further analysis or something like that. So another notable difference between sort of using sort of standard regular expression libraries alone and this is that this gives you an easy way to have sort of exceptions. Right. If you want to do something weird when you find a pattern, you can just write code to do that. And there's a pretty straightforward way of doing that. And that's the sort of thing which comes up when you're talking about antivirus software, where you have a pattern that matches a virus, but you know things change in some funny way, and you want to do some hand-coded check. It's a way of doing that. So I mentioned earlier that in the first section, in addition to putting stuff, things like variable declarations to copy in the C file, that we could put other things there. And the most notable example is that we can put sort of macros for our patterns. So rather than typing dot or new line all the time, when I mean any character, I can say define any to be a shorthand for that, and I can use that later on. And I can use that in the middle of a pattern, like you see here. So this lets you build up readable patterns without having a whole bunch of line noise in the middle of your file. So I told you that Flex basically does the fastest possible thing, which is one of the reasons why we're using it, and why we're using regular expressions in general. Regular expressions have a very fast, natural implementation, even when you have tons and tons of things to match. And the basic strategy is that you build a state machine. So who here has seen a state machine in some prior course? So most of you. So who has seen a picture kind of like this of a state machine in a prior course? So this is what Flex does, is it builds the equivalent of this picture. It doesn't build, like, draw the picture, but it makes lookup tables that implement this, and it keeps track of which state it's in. It gives each state a number, and it goes through character by character, switching from state to state. And it somehow combines all the regular expressions you give to build a full state machine that touches all of them. And in addition to sort of what's obviously shown, it also adds transitions between states, which deal with cases where you see an F and you don't see an O. And you need to, say, I really matched this pattern or this pattern here. It handles building that part of the table somehow. There's different mechanisms, but basically it's building this sort of state machine where it goes character by character and basically does one pass over everything. And the state machine's built statically. There's just every step is just a table lookup. So if you have a string like this, it starts here, it looks at an A, says that's not F, that's not new line, it goes here, it matches something, it executes the code for that match. And it goes through the first two characters that way. And if it starts with an F, then an O, it goes into this state, and then to the end, and executes the code for that match. But in cases where it doesn't go all the way, where we have an FO, then not an O, it matches the F, matches the O, and then it has the information in the table to know you need to go back to and process both of them, and they're going to process both of the things you saw with other patterns. And it builds the table to handle that efficiently. So we're not going to have you do that, do this by hand. That's been done a bit in previous semesters, but given that we cover state machines and other courses here, I don't think it's particularly useful. But I want to tell you how this works so you have an idea about why this is basically the fastest thing to do. So what Flex is building is basically a one-pass pattern matcher for a whole list of patterns. And you're pretty much doing one table lookup each time you look up which edge do we go on. And then maybe looking up what actions to do. In some cases, the actions are a little complicated because you missed two matches, but it's basically the fastest thing you can do to match patterns. And the sorts of patterns that you can express this way are basically the ones that regular expression language I showed you lets you express. And they're the ones you want to use to find things like viruses because you can do it efficiently. This arrow says go back to, and you match to, that is the first thing you match, and then you keep going on this. And then, to keep going back to the O and so on. O matching not this line. So Flex is working by building this state machine internally and compiling it, like, kind of hard-coded in a C function. So any questions about how Flex works or regular expression matching in general? Yes.
So in this example, does it pretty much go one character at a time?
Yeah, so in general, it's going to go one character at a time.
So then A and it's not A, it just checks B.
Yeah, and this is even the case, even in the case where we don't have something that matches right away, it will still probably build out the tables to go one character at a time. So its basic loop is read a character, do a table lookup based on the current state to update the state, and maybe do something as a result of that, and then do that again. Read a character, do a table lookup, update the state. Okay, so that's sort of the basic ideas of things, how Flex things work. So another thing I'd like to note that Flex has is it has these states, as they call them, which are not the same states we just talked about, where you can say, in between things you match, you can have a flag that's set, which enables or disables some patterns. So in this example, we say that we're in a string or we're in the initial state at some point. And seeing a quote switches us to being in the middle of a string. And in the middle of a string, we look for foos with this pattern, but not this pattern. So this program will print out foo in string and foo out a string based on whether we saw a quote before it or not, not terminated by another quote. So this lets us switch what patterns are active. So this is a handy thing you can do if you have that sort of style of pattern where you saw something earlier in the file and you want to check it later, want to see if you see something related later. And so you need to declare it in this section. There's %x. There's also %s. And the difference between the two is that %x is exclusive. So you notice here that this foo is unmarked and doesn't match when we have str active. We needed to explicitly list both the default state, which is initial, and str. If you use %s, you don't need to do that necessarily. Okay. Any questions about these states? Yeah.
Once you open a string, how does it know?
So this pattern matches in the middle of a string, and it says begin initial. So it goes back to the initial status. Yeah. So this is the second pattern here is the end of string pattern. Yes. With this type of state, yes. There's another kind of state where you can have multiple states at a time. And this is in the Flex manual. But I want to tell you that states exist because this might be handy. Yes?
Isn't the initial comma stir line multiple states at the same time?
That means the pattern is active in multiple states. That doesn't mean there's multiple states at the same time. So this initial comma stir means match any character in either the stir state or the initial state. Okay. So as I said, yeah, we're using Flex because it's a good example of one-pass matching, and it's surprisingly similar to what real virus signatures might commonly look like. Not all of them. There's other techniques we'll talk about. And real antivirus probably has a custom pattern engine, one that's not originally designed to like parse C files or other sort of source code, but it's basically similar. It's going to be something like regular expressions for most of the cases and a whole bunch of other special cases. Okay. And I note, in case you're curious, that Flex has an escape hatch, so you can like do IO directly from the matching code. There's even an unget function to say we match something, but we should try to match it again with other patterns. So it actually supports like all the ad hoc logic you'd expect from some custom pattern engine if you want to write it. And our future assignment, in particular, what we're going to have you do is we're going to have you match push followed by rect, which we determine is something that probably normal code won't do. You'd probably just use a jump. And look at how that works. So how would we use flex to detect, say, Vienna? Well, simplest thing is we just take the machine code for the fixed part of Vienna and match it. Or you could take the machine code for, say, other parts of Vienna, which might have unfixed parts, like the move that changes, and we could just have the any character placeholder for where those constants are. And the idea is that if we use something like this to find our virus patterns, that we can compile them into something which will efficiently look for all those patterns all at once. So I've shown you sort of basically how pattern matching would work, but there's some other things you might want to do where even this sort of very efficient scanning gets unwieldy. And one of the issues is that if our signatures are going to be something like the code for the virus or other things which are reliable, it seems like we have, even using Flex's strategy, that state machine, that picture I drew with like 5, 6 circles, might have like thousands of circles. Sure, it's just a table lookup each time, but that's probably actually pretty unwieldy. So if you want to have a flex parser with tens of thousands of states, yes, it's going to be the most efficient way to look for all those signatures, probably just scanning character by character, but there's probably something else we can do. And so real antivirus software often uses some shortcut to hopefully make the common case a little faster than actually building out the whole exact pattern matcher. And the key observation is that fixed strings dominate your patterns, is that you have these fixed string anchors you can look for. So what you'll commonly see is that you'll look for a fixed string, take a hash of it, and say, this fixed string hash appears in this piece of malware. This is not a reliable pattern because you're looking at, say, a 16-byte string. Sorry, I have this drawn over the actual string we'd be looking for, let's say. And then when you find something which hashes to the appropriate string, so you look through your file, you just take every, say, 16 bytes, hash it with something very fast hash function, and see if you find it in the table. And in that case, you go through a full pattern to see if it really matches. So using this sort of technique, you can make the scanner really fast. So you have your backup sort of full flex style pattern matching, but in the common case, you're just taking little bits and taking a hash on them and looking it up in a table, and you usually skip scanning over most of the file with the full patterns until you find like 16 whole bytes which matches, which is not going to happen very often. By chance, it will happen sometimes, but that's why we have the full pattern to look up. Yeah?
This is really, you're doing this as bytes, right? So you're actually scanning every byte.
Yeah, you do a moving window, and if you choose your hash function correctly, you can even make it so you can update the hash step by step. So it's actually, it's not like you're computing a hash over 16 bytes, you're actually computing two modifications to the hash value. Any questions on this sort of technique? Okay. And since we talked about sort of hypothetically how virus antivirus software might work. I thought I should give an example of what an example of a real virus signature format. The only one I could really access, which is in the most popular open source antivirus software, which is ClamAV, which is primarily used by people who run mail servers to scan attachments. So their signature format accepts multiple kinds of signatures. So they take hashes of files, that's a signature, hashes of the contents of a segment of an executable. So the antivirus software has some special code which extracts the parts of an executable or an archive file, but and then matches signatures against it. You can look for fixed string or basic regular expressions like the kind we saw with Flex. That's another kind of pattern they support. And they also support some very complete regular expressions, in particular Perl regular expressions, which turn out to support features you can't really implement with state machines. And they support meta signatures, so you can have a signature which is, did we find this signature and this signature and this signature? So did we find multiple patterns? If so, it's a match. And they also do have a special case where they do icon matching, where they look at icons and see if they look like a fake Word document icon or something like that. Because that's an email, that's a particular way that email worms try to spread. It's by having an executable whose icon looks like a Word document or something similar. Any questions on any of these? So this points out, at least for the open source world, that what you're doing with Flex is not actually that far off from what real patterns look like, which is kind of surprising, but actually the case. There's other things we'll talk about antivirus software doing, which are a lot more complicated, but also a lot slower. And speaking of slower, one thing I mentioned was that, well, we still have to read the whole file. So in addition to the issue of doing the pattern matching, there's also the issue of reading whole files to process them. And all these techniques we've seen still require reading the whole file, especially if you're like taking the hash of it, you have to read it. And antivirus software has tried to shortcut this, like maybe checking the entry point and the end of the file only, because that's usually where viruses go, and check, you know, known offsets where viruses commonly end up. You know, maybe have some heuristic about whether the entry point's close to the file. And so they implemented what Zur calls head or tail scanning. And that's why viruses don't always append or replace the executable. Because they quickly figured out, hey, if I put my code anywhere but the end or the beginning, this antivirus software I have here doesn't detect it. Okay, so next time we'll go into some more heuristic techniques for antivirus and also back into things that the antivirus software, sorry, the virus writers do to fight back. How do they actually, you know, make these signatures actually very useless? In the meanwhile, I have a note. So we've talked about signatures in sort of this cat and mouse game, and I have a completely unchecked and ungraded thing I'd like to point out. So Hanelbach has a talk on evidence in IT-based security, called In Search of Evidence in IT-based Security, and you can guess his opinion about that. I have it linked from the schedule page. It's about 30 minutes, it's extremely accessible. Given the audience is four, and it gives you exposure to one, so the sort of negative perspective about antivirus software, which will be relevant to when we see all the sorts of cat and mouse game that has happened between viruses and antivirus software. So as I said, I'm not checking, but I think it's interesting. That's all I have for today.